Hope everyone had a great Las Vegas show. I definitely noticed things were much busier and more active. A group of us on Tuesday went on the Zappos tour after some of us had read that first book regarding Zappos. So that was a lot of fun and definitely doing something different in Vegas. We had a good time. We got to see the Zappos main facility, and we learned that they're moving to downtown to, I think, a 2 million square foot facility in downtown Vegas. So that was very interesting. And while we were there, I asked, we had a question and answer session after the tour, and I asked them what their plans were for Bricks and Sticks. And the gentleman who was conducting the tour said that he definitely saw retail stores in their future. So those of you that are, you know, would like to have Zappos in some of your shopping centers, I would say start calling and, you know, getting in there and following up. And if you're a tenant rep firm, maybe look into that. So today's book is Onward, How Starbucks Fought for Its Life Without Losing Its Soul. And I thought that we would read about a retailer for a change of pace, because the last four or five books were more self-help and improvement. And since many of us probably were affected by what happened with Starbucks, I know I personally had a land lease deal that got pulled during their store closure situation that they talk about in the book. So I lost a deal, and I'm sure many of you on the call were personally affected by what happened with Starbucks. So I thought it would be a great book to read and learn and see what Howard experienced and some of his lessons learned. So just jumping right in, you know, one of the first things he talks about is how Starbucks is a personal experience, and how on page 5 he says, valuing personal connections at a time when so many people sit alone in front of their screens. And I find that, you know, and we talk about this in the past as well, that it's very easy to just send an email, and how personal connections is really what propels relationships and helps us get deals done because of deepening relationships. So I agree that having a place like Starbucks, he talks about it later in the book, that it's the third place, home being the first place, work being the second place, and he was hoping to create a third place where we could all go, and whether we did personal things or work things, that it was just a third place that we could go to. And I think that's true, because every time I go to Starbucks, I see tons of people. It's packed, and it's hard to find a comfortable chair to have a meeting or just work on your laptop. And I think that they have achieved that, having a Starbucks being created as a third place. When I travel a lot, and sometimes I meet people, and if you know, they don't meet me in the hotel lobby, it's always the go-to place. Well, where's the nearest Starbucks that we could meet at? So I think he's achieved that goal. He talks about summoning the courage to make choices that go against reason. And later on in the book, he talks about how when their stock was down significantly and Wall Street was screaming and his investors were screaming, that the number one recommendation by everyone was for him to franchise. And he said, you know, that would have absolutely pulled us out of our demise, but that we would never be able to achieve the goal of the personal service and the experience if we were to franchise. And I thought that was really interesting, because I agree that, and I think we all know many companies who franchise, and it absolutely dilutes the core when they do that. It's never the same, no matter how many rules and requirements the franchisor wants the franchisees to follow. It's never the same, and I think that he bucked the trend. You know, when everyone was telling him that was the way to turn things around, he didn't do it. And I found that to be very interesting in the book. On page 12, he talks a lot about when he was in Italy. And backing up, if someone would have asked me before I read the book, how long has Starbucks been in business, I probably would have said 15, 17, 19, 20 years. I had no idea they'd been in business 40 years. I just found that incredulous. I asked my assistant before the call, so how long do you think Starbucks has been in business? She said, I don't know, 10 years. So 40 years they've been in business. And, you know, basically he bought he joined the store when it had less than 10 locations, and he built it to what it is today. He obviously I had actually got an email by someone who said I had a typo in the announcement with the little letter CEO, and the reason I did that is in the book he talks about how everyone's titles are lowercase, including his. So that's why, just, you know, furthering the theme of the book and what we learned in the book, that's why it was in the announcement, the three small letters CEO. But he talked about going to Italy and walking into a store in Italy, and just the aroma of the coffee and the baristas having a personal relationship with the customer, and you know the importance of retailing. And I think that's important for us, because as we are out there canvassing and meeting with mom and pops, the difference between, you know, I always tell people I want retailers that I'm doing deals with to do two things. I want them to pay rent and open for business. You know, retailers that pay me rent but aren't open, you know, don't help my shopping center. And you know, retailers that are open and don't pay me rent certainly don't help me pay my mortgage payments. But I think this is a third thing, that when we find the retailers that have, you know, a core competency and have what he talks about, the aroma and the personal connection, they talk about in the book that at an average Starbucks, they can create 40,000 different concoctions of coffee. 40,000. That again blew my mind. I thought that was crazy. I go in, I'm very, you know, traditional and conservative. I have the same thing. You know, I either in the morning I have my latte and in the afternoon I have my frappuccino. I never veer from it. But since I've read the book, I was in Destin for a client last week and I tried their mint chocolate chip something or another. It was great. So now I'm going to be exploring more now that I've read the book. And he talks about how, and I'll talk about later, instead of store growth being a strategy, which obviously didn't work for them, product creation is the strategy, and creating new products is what really it helps them with their bottom line. So, but he talks about how retailers are successful when they have a unique product and they have unbelievable service. And when some of you have heard that here at Shops of Arrowhead, when I first bought it, I had realized I had a couple number one retailers in their concept. You know, I had the number one sub guy. You know, L'Espada's was voted by the Zagat Guide as the number one restaurant in Broward County, even beating out Capital Grille, which was crazy the day that I drove in and saw three news crews. I thought someone died, you know, on my sidewalk, and it turned out it was just that this 600-square-foot sub chain got voted number one in the Zagat Guide, and I also had the number one barbecue. And so I started going out, and I would collect the reader number one surveys from the New Times or the Miami Herald Neighbors or Sun Sentinel, and I would go out and start talking to those people, and in turn I got the number one ice cream. Maggie Moos was voted the number one ice cream. I got the number one hamburger guy in Big City Dogs, the number one patio, Jerry's Patio. And when you walk in and you're canvassing and you walk into the people that have been voted number one by their readers or their community, they want to talk to you because they're successful. They want to expand. A lot of times they already have more than one location. So it's a much easier discussion to have because they want what you want, success and expansion within reason. So, but I think that finding that retailer that goes above and beyond and, you know, isn't rude to their customers, you know, I think we all have had the experience where we have a retailer that we question how they can still be in business when they're so rude to their customers. We go to a pizza place, which we love, and the waitresses are so rude. I said to my sister the other day, I can't believe this woman has been this waitress here for 20 years, and, you know, she's still here. So the personal service. He talks about bringing in Jim Donald, which was the CEO who we eventually replaced, but he brought in, he said, rare traits that could not be learned regarding his heart, his conscience, and his emotional intelligence. And he told stories about how he would have an hour meeting, and at the end of 45 minutes, he'd cut the meeting short, and he told people, go take your 15 minutes to call someone that they usually don't contact every day. So this guy was a touchy-feely guy, and I think that was part of the brand back then, but you know, he obviously needed to have a few other qualities to help the company prosper, especially when we were hit with a full-blown recession, which is why Howard felt that he needed to come back in, that Jim wasn't the right guy for that. And when Howard did come back in, one of the things that he learned quickly about himself was he said, I knew all about retailing, and I knew all about products. He said, what I didn't know was I didn't know about back of the house, and I didn't know about delivery and what went on with deliveries. And he says, and I certainly didn't know all about the financials. And I think that many of us who have led companies, we get promoted because of certain talents we have, and then we get into a position of promotion like the Peter Principle, and we wake up and we go, wow, you know, I didn't know about this. And when you're a leader of a company, he says, you know, I never got caught up in the details. And he said, I realized that I really had to focus on the details, because that focusing on the details was what was going to pull us out of the demise and the downward spiral that they were heading into. And I had a personal experience, you know, when I was promoted from the head of leasing and, you know, all the way up to president, I got to a role where I never had experience running a company with financials, and I got us into a little bit of a trouble and went to my partner, boss, and I said, now what do? He goes, you start firing people. So big wake-up call, big learning experience, and boy, did I learn really quick after that about the financials. And, you know, I like to motivate salespeople and I like to do deals, but now as a president of a company, you had to do so many more things, and you had to have your fingers on so many different pulses. And if you find yourself in a position that you are lacking in certain areas, there's so many educational opportunities out there to improve those skills, and so many people out there that will help you. And that's what he did. He started bringing people in, and he really educated himself on the areas he was weak in, and he believes that that really helped get the company back on track. But he talks about back to the retailer and the merchant success, and he says the merchant success depends on his or her ability to tell a story. What people see or hear or smell or do when they enter a space guides their feelings, entices them to celebrate whatever the seller has to offer. And I think that's important when we're canvassing. When we walk into a space, do we have an emotion? Do we get a feeling? Do we want to buy? And if we do, those are the retailers and the mom and pops that we want in our shopping centers. He talks about when he travels, he goes to other retailers. He says that, you know, it's not unusual, no matter where I'm in the world, to hop in a cab and go walking to visit other retailers. And I do that as well. You know, whether I'm in New York or California, I'm always looking for, you know, what retailer is hot. Or back in 4 years ago, if you went to California, you saw a yogurt store on every corner. Obviously, that was going to come to us, and it has. So it's important, whether you're on vacation or not, to keep our eyes and ears open to what's happening in those markets, because it's inevitable that it probably will come to our area, and then, you know, we're ahead of the game. He talked a lot about, which really plays into what we do, the lack of discipline with the expansion program. And trying to find that in the book here, but he talked about as he started getting involved in figuring out what the problems were and figuring out how deep the problems went. He said almost immediately my work habits shifted as my level of discipline had heightened. I no longer could be freewheeling with my daily schedule. I began spending quiet time alone early in the morning, skimming the news before 6 and jumping on the phones at 7. And you know, I think we've talked about this before with other books where people have said to us, you need to have quiet time to think. And when it's tough, like when we've just lived through this recession, and I know we're coming out of it and things are better, we have to work harder. We have to be more disciplined. And, I talked to a client on Monday where she said, I'm really, you know, things are getting so busy again, I'm falling down behind on my cold calling. And I said the same thing, exactly that to her. You need to be disciplined. You need to take every day, whether it's from 9 to 9:30 or 5:30 to 6, and make those five, if your goal is 5 calls a day or 10 calls a day, you got to shut off the phones and creating a discipline to do it. I sent her an email yesterday because I had five specific cold calls that I wanted to make, and I shut my door. I turned off my laptop, and I just made the five phone calls. It's not hard to make them, but it's hard to get your head disciplined. And I find that if you do it every day at the same time or 3 days a week, the same thing with canvassing, that helps. He talks about bringing in, he added a lot to his senior leadership team, but he talked about, I don't shy away from people who respectfully disagree with me. You know, if everyone in the room shares the same opinion, you're not going to go far. And I think that that's important in our world, whether you're working with a not-for-profit, even in our own families. We need people that can respectfully disagree with us. Otherwise, how would we come up with new ideas? He talks about swinging for the fences. He said that when he was a boy, the way that he beat out bullies was he was very good at sports. So even if he wasn't the tallest or the biggest kid on the team, if he could run the fastest or get a bigger hit, that shut up the competitors. And he said, with Starbucks, I'm constantly swinging for the fences, if it fiscally makes sense. And even when you have groups like McDonald's competing with you, because they're the big boys, you need to keep your head down. And if your instincts tell you this is the right move, you keep forward and you do it. You know, McDonald's, he says in the book how McDonald's and Wall Street became kind of a team, and they had, it was all over the Wall Street Journal, that during the recession, the consumers have given up their $4 latte. And he's saying that the latte isn't even $4, and it was just a great campaign for people to consider, is this a luxury that we can afford? What he found is people still came in the morning, but they gave up their afternoon treat, and they did things to improve that, and traffic eventually came back, whether they did the loyalty cards, they did promotions. For the first time ever, Starbucks never advertised, and they started with a Twitter campaign and social media and the loyalty cards and different products, and it brought people back into the store. Digressing, I am giving away three books. The next book I am so excited about. I'm not even finished with it, and I love it, and you guys are going to love it too. And as I tell you guys, you don't have to read the books. You have to read this book. If you're going to the ICSE in Orlando in August, you must read the book. So I'm giving away three copies, and today I'm not going to give them to, just different numbers. I'm going to give them to whosever birthday is today, and please tell us on the phone if your birthday is today, or whoever has a birthday closest to today. So email us when your birthday is, if you think it's close to today, and those three people with the closest birthdays today, it could be yesterday, 2 days ago, 2 days from now, will get the new book. The book is called Never Eat Alone, by Keith Ferrazzi, and it's fabulous, and it gives so many tips about conferences and networking. I just love it. So please, please read the book, because I won't be able to share with you in 45 minutes on, I think, July 12th is when we're having the call. I won't be able to share with you all of the tidbits that I want you to learn from that book. Okay, so back to Starbucks. So send us an email. Josie's monitoring those, and we'll give away three books to the people that are the closest with the birthdays. So he talks about how positive comps, as we all know, in our national retail relationships, that's, the mainstay. But he says that really killed them, and that he'd go into stores and go, why are you guys doing this? And he goes, because it's returning, it's helping with our positive comps. And he said that the comps were becoming the reason to exist and overshadowing everything else. So he decided to stop reporting the comps, which met with huge conflict and argument from the street, but he did it anyway. And he says sometimes when you're the boss, you have to make hard calls. Obviously, when he had to lay off, I think, 10% of his workforce and close, I think he started with 600 stores, and in the end it was over 1,000 stores, and pulled a bunch of deals, including mine, that met with, that put him on the front page of every Wall Street. One of the quotes was, is Starbucks losing its mojo? But you have to make tough decisions. And he and like I said earlier, he said, in any well-run retail business, there is by definition a maniacal focus on details. And he says, in 2008, I felt very strongly that many of us at Starbucks had lost our attention to details of our business, where global comps and rapid expansion and comps were the number one thing we focused on, which was a big, you know, big mistake. I said in the announcement of the call about big words. So many young people that I mentor are always trying to reach out and use, you know, elaborate vocabulary, and because they hear other people do it, and it comes across as unnatural. And I always tell them, just use your own language. You'll learn new words, and you'll be able to use them. And he talked about that in Chapter 12. He says, I've long believed in the power of a word or a single phrase to effectively communicate a business imperative and to inspire people. The best words are never big or complicated, but are packed with emotion and meaning, leaving no question of what I expect of myself and others. I cannot tell you how many times early in my career I would say, use words that absolutely was not the word I wanted to use. And it made me look silly and foolish. And, of course, I had lovely people around me to point that out to me. And, you know, it became a humorous thing. But it's always better to just try to use basic words to get, because communication is so important, and it's not important to try to use four-syllable words to make yourself look important. So, especially for the young people on the call, this happens a lot when I talk to them, and so I loved reading that here the guy, the head of Starbucks, says this in the book, because I love that. He talks about how important it is for the leaders of companies, and I know a lot of you on the call are directors of leasing teams. It says, I remain extremely conscious of how people might interpret anything I do or say, my body language, whether I was smiling or pursing my lips in frustration. I strove to be authentic and frank while threading optimism. Yes, we had hard work and challenges ahead, but we will get through this difficult time. We've all been through 3 years of a difficult time, and it's important that we as leaders of the companies, I had a partner once that said, you know, when you're walking down the halls, no matter how bad it is, you know, the team doesn't need to know it, and you need to fake it until you feel it. But, you know, you can't have a scrunch up face and, you know, think the sky is falling because, you know, your team looks up to you. And that's what he was saying is, look, everyone knew it was bad, but they needed to look to me to believe that I had optimism that we could solve the problems of the situation. On page 133, I loved it when he talks about bringing Jim Senegal from Costco, the CEO of Costco, in. Howard did a great job of using other people. Later on, he talks about Bill Bradley, a coach, you know, inspiring the team. But to reach out to other retailers, Costco, Jim said, protect and preserve your core customers. The cost of losing your core customers and trying to get them back during a down economy will be much greater than the cost of investing in them and trying to keep them. That's so important for us because we need to keep our tenants. You know, in the last 3 years, craziness has happened. People have tried to, you know, lure our tenants away at lower, cheaper deals. I'm guilty of that as well because I canvass all the time. But it's our job as landlords to keep our tenants. And whether knowing what their sales are, knowing what they can afford to pay, knowing what's going on in the market, knowing what our competition is offering because of our relationships with our competition, it's so important because it takes, but once the tenant moves out, the ability to replace that tenant, the time lost, the rent lost. So it's our job, if we want to keep those tenants, it's our job to keep those, and as Jim Senegal says, our core customers. So Howard brings back in Arthur Rubenfeld. So Arthur was the first head of real estate, and he was a very disciplined guy. And Howard said, I had to bring back Howard because what went on with the real estate expansion and store designs, you know, he believes was a big part of what hurt the business. So he Arthur, the first, that's when they decided that they would start closing stores. They started working on store design. They say in the book that they used to be known as the retailer who could cookie cut and open the stores the fastest and not not work on, he said after Arthur left, the company deviated from the approach of store site selection as deliberate. He said keeping costs low became paramount, and no one was rewarded for intelligent design. He said Starbucks became the envy of the retail industry for the ability to quickly retrofit. He said, meanwhile, competitors, old and new, went to school on us. He said Arthur came back and reestablished the coffee house authority. He reduced the concept design staff from 60 down to 9. He worked with Mike Malanga to right-size the portfolio of stores, which included the difficulty of closing stores and winding down leases. He said that Arthur had joined the company in 91 when there was 100 stores, and that he said Arthur understood better than I did that real estate needed to play a critical role in the company's expansion and branding, but not the number one role, and that the Starbucks bloated real estate portfolio and its stale store design contributed to the downside. So, and Arthur's still there today. So, absolutely now they're back and they're expanding again. And I know that there are deals on the table. So, I don't know if anyone from you guys that are local have been in the Aventura store, but I was in there about a month ago, and they have these higher tables, and they're long, and they're more communal tables. They also talked in the book in different markets where they are doing. All their stores are becoming LEED stores because they believe in the environment, and they talk a lot in the book about giving back and being environmentally conscious. And but the stores are becoming different, and they say when they go in certain markets, they create stores and use like old barn doors, and they use things from the community in the stores to make the store a more homey feel and more applicable to their environment, which I thought was really cool. We haven't seen any of that down here. The first store different design that I've seen is in the Aventura store. He talks about the store managers. He says the best store managers are coaches, marketers, entrepreneurs, community ambassadors, and merchants all at once. He said they're optimistic problem solvers, that they take their jobs personally, and they treat the store as its very own. And excuse me, earlier I said that there were 40,000 different combinations. On page 148, 80,000 different combinations of coffee that you can have in a Starbucks store. How crazy is that? 80,000. He talks about when he pulled the plug on the new store openings, it was 348. So Arthur and Mike got together and they said that they needed to make some drastic steps, and they pulled the plug on 348 planned store openings. He said that He talks about that, and historically, the average Starbucks store in the United States brought in $1 million annually. He said, but revealing the lack of discipline in the real estate decisions, in his opinion, was an example of the hubris that had taken hold. He said, I took another deep breath. From where I sat as CEO, the pieces of our rapid decline were coming together in my mind. Growth had been a carcinogen. When it became our primary operating principle, it diverted attention from revenue and cost-saving opportunities, and we did not effectively manage expenses as rising construction costs and additional money spent on new equipment went crazy. And then he talks about, I had a situation once about, 10 or 15 years ago. I was representing a national retailer, and it was about September, October, and the rep called me and said, we need to hurry up and get a store open by year end. How's that Boynton Beach location? Do you think we can get that back on the books? And I said, why would we want Boynton Beach? We turned that market down. And she said, we told Wall Street we're going to open 32 stores, and I've got to get one open. And, all the reps are trying to get one more. And I thought at the time, very junior in my career, so Wall Street is guiding real estate decisions. This can be very dangerous. And that retailer ended up filing bankruptcy not so long ago. So, that's just not the way that we would hopefully what has happened in the last 3 years has changed. some of these retailers with Wall Street? I don't know. I think that we're starting to see, you know, in the last 3 years, we've had a lot of national and regional retailers not expanding, and there's a lot of pent-up demand, and their stock prices are not increasing, and, you know, the way to grow is same-store comp sales or expansion. And with the unemployment that we have, I don't know if same-store comp sales are going to be increasing, so probably it's going to be store expansion. I guess that's good for us, that the people that own real estate and manage and lease real estate, the pent-up demand will help us do more national and regional retailers' locations. But in the end, how far do they take that? And then does it affect their company? And then we end up with dark stores like these retailers recently, in the last 3 years, that have filed bankruptcy. So back to the book. They talk about how they, on page 162, how they negotiated with landlords. And they said, you know, hundreds of landlords were calling them. You know, they had customers sending emails, please save the store. And he said, you know, we tried to strike fair deals and spent millions of dollars to make the best of a bad situation for all. We tried to put ourselves in the shoes of the landlord and acted accordingly to expedite the process. In my case, I didn't have a Starbucks close. I just had a deal pulled, and, you know, it was a shame, and it hurt, but, you know, I'm not sure, as a landlord, I didn't deal with one of the stores closing, so I'm not sure how they dealt, you know, with us. I said on page 174 is when he talked about investors wanting Starbucks to undo our company-owned and operated store model and franchise the system, letting other people own and operate our stores and pay Starbucks royalties. On its face, it made economic sense. Franchising would have given us a war chest of cash and significantly increased our return on capital. But if Starbucks ceded ownership of stores to hundreds of individuals, it would have been harder for us to maintain the fundamental trust our store partners had in the company and connection they established with customers. He said, I believe it would have created a very different organization and would have diluted our unique culture forever. And he did it. He decided not to do that, which in the end worked in his favor. They start pulling out. They cut costs, they cut stores, they cut personnel, and they start creating new products. And things start improving. He talks on 222 that he needed some. He said, I never stopped believing that Starbucks would emerge from the darkness, but I nonetheless experienced an emotional roller coaster daily. I tried, admittedly not always successfully, to keep my feelings in check, and I was acutely aware of my mood's domino effect. Foremost, our people needed reassurance of my own confidence. That's why I felt the freedom to be candid with a trusted friend who proved to be a psychological benefit, as it was educational. He goes, I'm human, and I needed an outlet. And I think we all need an outlet, and we all need to not be afraid to be vulnerable, to ask for help when we need it. He said, I needed to instill confidence. As he was getting ready to walk out and talk to a room full of investors and Wall Street and probably landlords and his employees, he said, I was insecure about my ability to instill confidence. He said, and just like that, he said, Bill Bradley walked into the room. He said he corralled our attention and delivered what must have been a 15-minute pep talk, reinforcing our strengths. He said, everyone in the company was feeling pain, and everyone in the country was feeling pain, and Starbucks had a good story to tell. He said, I don't know how Bill Bradley knew we needed that locker room speech, but it gave us what we needed, which was an unexpected burst of positive energy. So I think that sometimes, like I said, we all need to reach out and look for motivation and inspiration from other people. He talks about the whole, since I love the Frappuccino, I love the whole paragraph of how that came to be, and I really enjoyed all of the paragraphs where he talked about the Pike Roast coffee. But he talked about execution and you know, a lot of retailers are entrepreneurs. And he said taking a more cautious, calculated approach to innovation goes against my just-do-it entrepreneurial nature, which plays off my gut and pushes for speed. but I was recognizing that the company and I needed to shift the way we brought products to the market. He said, I no longer wanted the company's growth to rely only on building more stores. Starbucks' future depended on its ability to innovate on several fronts. And what other retailers do we see that do that? And, you know, should we be careful or be mindful of that? And, you know, and how healthy are they and how long will they last if they continue to just grow on store growth and not focusing on the details and focusing on their customers? He says that retailing is in his DNA. How many retailers do you know, especially the mom and pops, that retail is in their DNA? He talks about being at the heart of every merchant is a desire to tell a story by making a sensory emotional connection. Think about what retailers in your shopping centers do that and the ones that you prospect, and those are probably the ones that will open additional locations. He quoted a guy in Italy who he says was one of the best retailers he ever went in, and he says that in retail you have to keep your surroundings fresh. He said the more that the furniture, floor, and fixtures age, the greater the need for meticulous and periodic maintenance. Old is beautiful, but not if it's neglected. And that's from a shop that from a guy named Aldo Lorenzi, the shop in Via Monte, who knows, I don't know how to say it. But that's so true. We all have tenants that have spaces that are worn out, that need refreshing or need maintenance, and hopefully our property management departments can help give them that advice to help improve their surroundings, because I think the customer recognizes that and understands that and notices that. So they talk about, as I mentioned before, they're preserving the materials they're using for their new stores. Go from the store's floor, ceiling, wood columns, cabinets, and door handles have been preserved from nearby buildings and farms and from recycled from things like laundry bottles and old wine barrels. He said one of the long tables in Seattle had been used in a local restaurant, and a slate menu came from a classroom from one of the oldest high schools in Seattle. He said paint is carefully chosen to avoid interfering with the store's coffee aroma. You know, he talks a lot about the aroma in the book and how important it is to the customer, which I think I agree it's true. And he says that, you know, they got rid of breakfast sandwiches because he felt that the breakfast sandwich, the cooking of it, interfered with the aroma of the coffee, and then so many people wrote in are begging for them to return the sandwiches, so they put a whole team on figuring out how to get rid of the sandwich smell so that they could have the sandwiches and not have it interrupt the aroma. They started a new concept, which I didn't even know, called coffee and tea, and the new all the stores are named after the street that they are located on to have it be a more personal experience. The first one was called 15th Avenue Coffee and Tea. It opened in July of 2009. The second one was called Roy Street Coffee and Tea. And he talks about how they're going to roll that out, but on a much smaller basis. The store is 2,000 square feet, and they have movie nights, poetry readings, and more music entertainment. So furthering on to the experience, they want to really capture more evening customers with this concept. So we should watch for that as real estate professionals. So, you know, winning in chapter 32, he says, so in the third quarter of fiscal 2009, they earned $152 million, which was compared to losing $7 million a year earlier. You know, phenomenal. He says that there's never a finish line, however, and that we absolutely need to continue to focus on the details and the brand. You know, I think some of us probably watched CNBC Morning Joe. You know, they collaborated, and Morning Joe is now sponsored by Starbucks, where before they had never done any marketing. They felt that they needed to do that. You know, they said no one thing led to the company's spiral, just as no one thing led to its resurgence. He said, my leadership continued to evolve, balancing my entrepreneurial vision with my patience of execution and paying the same degree of attention to the back end of the business that I was hardwired only to pay attention to the front end. And by no means was I doing it alone. Starbucks was on the verge of having the strongest leadership team in history. You know, and he talks on page 309, he talks about his list, like his, you know, top 15 things. But the first one he says, which so applies to what we do, he says, grow with discipline. It's throughout the book he talks about that, you know, I believe from me reading the book that the biggest decline was their crazy growth and how it got out of hand. And number one on his list of his top 15 or 20 of what they need to do going forward is grow with discipline. They, you know, they bought Seattle's Best Coffee, which they're, you know, calling it SBC, and they're rolling out those stores as well, but slower, on a slower pace. And, you know, he talks about he wants to consider the untapped potential within our own organizations. They have implemented programs for not only the partners in their stores but the customers to give ideas. And he said, you know, 15 or 20% of the ideas the customers have turned in have become new things that they do in stores, which is so cool. I love that. But he says on 315, back again, growth, we now know all too well, is not a strategy. And when undisciplined growth becomes a strategy for Starbucks, we lose our way. We are no longer growing the company we did in the past. Starbucks today aims to be a very different type of company. They absolutely talk about product innovation. They talk a lot about, they had a whole couple chapters on the decaf, on the instant coffee, which my friend actually gave me, she works for Starbucks, she gave me some instant coffees and I didn't try it. Well, now, I have to try it because they talk about doing taste tests with people that are so anti-instant coffee and, you know, they can't tell the difference. So I'm going to definitely do that after reading the book. They give back to their community 1 million hours each year, which I think is fabulous. And, you know, the stock now is back up to $32.76, so it's up 400% from December 08, Starbucks stock closed at $32.78, which was 400% up. So, you know, a big success story, lots of different learning lessons that we can all, you know, use. You know, if everyone, like I said, gets one idea from this call, you know, that's what I'm hoping we all get out of it. But I learned a lot, and especially for a retailer that we all have experience with, that probably as a landlord, there are tenants, and as customers. So I hope you guys enjoyed the book. A couple other announcements. So today in the Miami Herald, while Winn-Dixie is going after all the dollar stores. So if you guys have lots of shopping centers with either Winn-Dixie or Dollar General or Dollar Tree, you should find that article in the Miami Herald today. T-Mobile merging with AT&T. There's an article that a lot of the T-Mobile stores are in jeopardy of closing. So if you have T-Mobile, check that out. I have Retail the Rockstar on June 30th. It's sold out. I'm probably going to be doing another one in September. And also, pretty soon I'll be having my DVDs. I did a keynote speech in Atlanta last September, 6 hours for the shopping center group Chainlinks, and we're going to have that those DVDs available. So if anyone is interested in those, send me an email. And last but not least, I will tell you the three people that are winning the book. And they are Laura Lynch, Danny Diaz, and Jesse W. So you three, congratulations, win the next book. So I hope you didn't already buy it. If you did, send me an email, and I'll send you the next book we're going to do the following month. So thank you guys so much. I hope you enjoyed our Lunch and Learn for July. And go read this book and get ready, because July 12th we're going to be talking about ICSC Orlando, and it's going to be a fabulous conversation. You're going to love the book. So happy Thursday. Take care. Bye-bye.